before I went into that world of high altitude climbing, I didn't really understand what suffering was or how to suffer, or the idea that you had to perform under unideal circumstances, which is basically all high altitude climbing is. And with big wall free climbing, like climbing on LCAP and trying to like free climb LCAP in a day, it's this perfect combination between this suffering and these unforeseen circumstances and kind of having to push through and hard technical rock climbing. So I think that base of being a sport climber and a competition climber and, you know, delving into this world of high altitude climbing kind of formed the base that later became big wall free climbing. And that's when I discovered that that was one of my biggest passions.
Hello and welcome to the Duffel Shuffle. I'm Adrian Ballinger, and we're here to discuss the world of climbing and skiing in all its forms through the eyes of mountain guides.
And I'm Sam Kiekheffer. In each episode, we'll unpack exhilarating stories, share invaluable insights, and get up close and personal with some of the most experienced and passionate guides and athletes in the industry.
Whether you're a seasoned alpinist or a weekend warrior, the Duffel Shuffle is your ticket to the thrilling world of climbing, skiing, and mountaineering. Join us.
Adrian, good afternoon.
How's it going, Sam?
Doing well. We're here on March 13th, recording episode one. We're a few weeks ahead of schedule. This episode will be coming
behind schedule or ahead of schedule?
Ahead of the schedule we just agreed on a few minutes ago, which is behind the original schedule. This episode will be coming out in early April, but we're going to start off each episode with some current events, talk about some relevant news in the world of mountain sports. Today, we've talked about a couple stories. First, we're going to start off with some tragic news out of the Alps. You want to share kind of what's been going on over the past few days?
Yeah. So I, you know, no personal connection, but I just came home from the Alps. Emily and I and our kiddo Arrow just spent 5 weeks in central Switzerland, based out of a town called Andermatt, which I'd love to just spend the episode talking about Andermatt and skiing in the Alps.
Engelberg, remember? Engelberg. You were in Engelberg,
right,
and it's
right. The there. Locals don't want us to tell any more people how great Andermatt is. That's another future episode, localism and people's stress around telling how awesome these places and sports are and encouraging more people to do them. I obviously fall on the side of let them come. Like, these things change our world, and I want them to have the opportunity to change other people's world for the better as well. But that is not the subject of today's podcast, and I'm certainly not an expert on it. As I was flying home from Switzerland a couple of days ago, I started getting pinged by friends and some media wanting to make sure I wasn't involved with or did I know anything about this accident that had just happened on the Haut Route. So the Haut Route is a famous backcountry skiing or ski touring route that goes from Chamonix to Zermatt. And it usually takes 5 or 6 days. People often do small sections of it as day trips. And some really remarkable athletes do the whole thing as one day, right? Almost like in a race type form. And this season in the Alps has just been a really great one, relatively good stability from an avalanche perspective, lots of big storms punctuated with sunny days in between. That's what made it so much fun for me and Em. We don't know a lot of the details, and certainly I don't know specifics about people who are up there, but this unfortunate story or incident has happened where it looks like a group of 6 skiers, possibly in really lightweight gear, might have been racing or training, were caught in a storm close to the Matterhorn on the Haut Route, and ultimately killed, not by an avalanche, not by crevasse fall, it seems, but by the elements, by the cold. They probably planned on getting down from the big mountains before the storm that night came in. The storm came in a little bit earlier and caught them up really high with minimalist gear. And it looks, I believe, 5 of 6 have been found, and they probably froze and might have tried to dig a snow cave to survive in. So it's this heartbreaking story. And, you know, of course, my heart goes out to them and their families and friends and communities. And I'm sure we'll learn a lot more details over the upcoming weeks. But it, two things jumped out to me when I'm thinking from a mountain guide's perspective of what happened or what might have happened. One was that because of the incoming storm, helicopters were not able to fly and assist in the rescue. So a call for help did come in. It was still daylight, but helicopters couldn't get up to the area because of the winds and probably low visibility. And that's something I constantly battle with is, you know, Sam, so well, how big our backpacks can get if we prepare for every eventuality. And that certainly makes skiing a lot less fun. So every single day I go skiing in the mountains, I am conflicted with how much to bring versus how much pleasure to have out of my light backpack. And I'm not sure I ever get it right. You know, for a while, I won't carry this thing, whatever it might be. And then I'll scare myself and I'll start adding it again. And then I'll feel too heavy for a while. And finally, I'll decide to drop those things again, whether it's a bigger first aid kit or a bivy shelter or a stove. And I think those are really interesting challenges that we have in our sport. We choose how big our safety net is every day. And I find it a difficult decision. Do you struggle with any of that?
Yeah, I was talking with someone the other day about how, you have a near miss and your kit grows. And then over time, you don't have any incidents and that kind of slims down. And it's this constant up and down. I had an incident that I was a first responder on Shasta last year. I was guiding a client and we came across a gentleman that had spent the night out with no overnight gear. And he was so hypothermic that he wasn't shivering. He'd taken his boots and gloves off because he thought he was hot.
Yeah, that's far along.
And I had a bivy sack that I always carry when I'm guiding in the big mountains. And we were able to put him in that bivy sack. And then fortunately, he had a jet boil in his backpack. No tent, no sleeping bag, but he had a jet boil. We were able to get him some warm fluids and eventually he was shivering. We got a helicopter to come and hoisted him off the mountain. But since then, I've started guiding Shasta with a little jet boil stash stove. Obviously, we bring that to camp, but typically I would leave my stove at camp for my summit push. And, I don't know how many grams it is, but it's fairly light, maybe a half pound with a small, and I'll run this, I have a small 4 ounce fuel canister that I'll even take some fuel out of to lighten it up. But just having this one little item, I think really made the difference in saving his life. And since then, I've started carrying it. We'll see how long I can last before I ditch it from the kit. But a tragic accident out of the Alps. And obviously, there's a lot of speculation. We don't have many details at this point, and there may never be details. But it is interesting. You ski in the Alps, and the helicopter rescue is such a prevalent thing that a lot of people in the Alps are ripping around in some of the biggest terrain that we ski in with some of the smallest packs that you see in big terrain. And there's this reliance, you ski the Vallée Blanche and a helicopter is going to be there before you can dig an anchor to rescue someone from a crevasse. And so you ski with, your rescue line clipped up at a high point on your shoulder strap. And that's how it's done there. But you take that potential out of the mix, and the risk tolerance categorized, it's a completely different environment if that helicopter can't fly.
Think I'm going to say this a lot during this podcast. It's like, oh, we should do an episode about this with an expert, like, one of the heli rescue crew from the Alps. It is truly incredible what's being done with helicopters in the Alps and how many lives have been saved. And some of those techniques are now moving into the Himalaya. And it's super interesting as people are starting to have the ability to make the same decisions of how and where to drop weight because of helicopter access. And I think not to generalize Americans, but we have this idea of like, you have to be independent and be able to take care of yourself in all situations. But kind of the flip side of the coin is I think the sport, our sports, alpinism, ski mountaineering and big mountain high altitude rock climbing, all of the levels of all of those sports are being pushed probably first in the Alps and at a higher level in the Alps than in the United States. And I think part of that is perhaps this willingness to take a bit more risk, to travel lighter, this knowledge that there are helicopters and assets there that may be usable. Although I think every user at a high level understands it might not be possible to get a helicopter rescue when and if you need one. But so I do think it's this fascinating kind of like balancing act of the cutting edge of our sport and the risks that it takes to be at the cutting edge of our sport, and then kind of our more conservative mountain guidey brain that's like, we need to be ready for anything. I don't think one, personally, I don't think one is right or wrong. They're both pushing the sports in different ways. And I'm interested to learn more from this incident and maybe some of the decisions that were made that led into this. Hopefully we can all learn from it.
Yeah, it's really interesting too. And I was just thinking about, you know, you mentioned that they were suspected to be moving light and fast in the mountains. And there's such a trend these days to reduce grams wherever you can. You look at, you know, outerwear and hard goods, and the marketing is all about, you know, shaving 20 grams here and 50 grams mm-hmm. here. And I can shave a lot of that weight by leaving my first aid kit behind, mm-hmm. my bivy sack behind. And, you know, I can buy a new $700 shell and lose a few hundred grams, or I can just leave some existing equipment behind. And so the kind of preparedness mixed with this ability to move lighter and faster and kind of want and you know, need to move fast in the mountains. And how is moving fast a safety mechanism versus a risk tolerance factor? It kind of goes on both sides.
Also true. I can't remember the quote that is from one of our old famous climbers, some crusty old guy, I'm sure. You know, if you bring bivy gear, you'll use bivy gear. And there is certainly a place where actually speed and efficiency is the greatest piece of your safety system. And that has to be balanced against additional weight. I think we're going to talk briefly about Everest here in our current news, but that might be one tie-in that, you know, I think a lot about that when I used to go through the Khumbu Icefall on the south side of Mount Everest, this really dangerous section of the normal route in Nepal, where everyone is forced to travel through an area where every day there are dozens of avalanches or ice falls. And there's a lot of luck to that section. But I would argue the single greatest risk mitigation tool was speed. Less time in that environment was the one way to be less likely to get yourself killed. The Sherpa would use that by just being incredibly strong and motivated, and could often move through the ice fall in 2 to 2.5 hours, whereas an average member of a team might have used to take 6 to 7 hours. And we now, on some of the inexperienced Everest teams, are seeing people spend 12 to 16 hours inside that ice fall. Well, that number of hours is just additional time on one of the most dangerous places on the planet. So certainly speed can be safety and is a tool we use.
Well, that kind of ties us into our next topic of changes in the Himalaya. The Everest season is upcoming. You'll be leaving for Everest in roughly 6 weeks or so.
Yep.
You know, the big news for the Alpenglow team is that the north side of Mount Everest is back open. So been closed for 4 years to non-Chinese climbers. And we'll be returning to the north side of Mount Everest in just a few weeks here. The Chinese have mentioned some changes potentially to their programming and how they operate on the north side of the mountain, but it's been yet to be seen exactly what those regulations are. And then on the south side, the Nepalese government has also come out with some new requirements that may or may not stick. What do you have on that?
Yeah, so I'm just so excited to return to Everest. I guess start with that. personal note, like you said, 4 years of closures on the north side. I now only climb and guide from the north side of the mountain after spending 8 years on the south side. I decided that the risks were just too great to my clients and especially to my team, my working teammates, Sherpa, staff, mountain guides. And so moved to the north side back in 2015 and had a great few years. And then, yeah, the closure due to COVID means I just wrote this in an Instagram post and I couldn't believe it when I wrote it, that it will have been almost 5 years since I've been on Mount Everest. And the whole time flies cliche, like I am in it. When I wrote that, I was like, no, that's not right. And I redid the math like twice more. It's not difficult math. It feels like a long time. So I'm so excited. That's my personal news. We have a great team. I think we have, 7 mountain guides and quite a few members going both to the summit and then partway climbers coming to experience the mountain but not go all the way to the summit. 14 Sherpa joining the team. It's just going to be wild to all be working together again for this common goal. But your question was about what's news or current affairs. Yeah, you know, on the Chinese side, the big news that they are reopening for the season. We just heard yesterday that it sounds like the opening date for our Sherpa will be sometime in the first week of April, which is great. It's an early opening as compared to some seasons, which allows our team to begin establishing the mountain and camps and things like that. So all good news. The one big regulation that we didn't know whether it was going to happen or not, but once we applied for our permit and had to send climbing resumes of each team member, the Chinese government is requiring that every summit climber has climbed a 7,000 meter peak before going to Mount Everest. They already required that every Chinese climber has to have actually climbed an 8,000 meter peak. So one of the 14 mountains in the world that are above 26,000 feet tall or 8,000 meters. It's interesting to me that for foreign climbers, they're not making the same regulation. They're saying 7,000 meters or 23,000 feet, which should include mountains like Amar de Blam, Aconcagua, things that are almost 7,000 meters and are common training peaks for the Himalaya. Alpenglow has already done this for years. We require our climbers to have a number of 6,000 meter peaks and then a 7,000 meter peak. And if in the group trip, an 8,000 meter peak. Experience is the one single most important thing for success and also enjoyment and finally for safety of you and your teammates. So this new rule doesn't affect us directly in terms of our team members, but I believe it will affect who's on the mountain and the overall safety and competency of people on the mountain. And I am so excited to see that rule. And I hope they extend it all the way to 8,000 meters in the future. The downside of that rule and the fact that they are actually enforcing it is people who don't meet that regulation, some will choose not to just go and get that requirement to climb on Aconcagua or some other mountain first. They'll choose instead to go to the south side of the mountain, to Nepal, where there are no experience requirements of the climbers or the working Sherpa and guides or the expedition leaders. And Nepal is famous for each spring doing a big PR push of new rules on the mountain. We're seeing the same thing this year, but there are no new rules around experience requirements for the companies or the climbers. And I'm sad to see that. The rules that we all are seeing, we know most probably won't actually be instituted, but a couple worth maybe hearing about. One is they're requiring everyone to wear, they say, GPS chips while on the mountain to make rescue easier. There's been a lot of joking going around and memes in our tiny little fishbowl world of 8,000 meter peak climbing because they said the GPS chips will cost around $15 each. So we can pretty much assume that they're not GPS. They're probably Reco reflectors. Without going too in depth, these are a system that have been used in the past, especially for finding people in avalanches. They're not as effective as avalanche beacons. But they can, with this special device that's used for searching, often from a helicopter, they can help to find someone who wasn't wearing an avalanche beacon. They have been found with lost hikers in the past as well, again, using a helicopter. I think there's nothing wrong with requiring climbers to use them on Everest. I think the application will be limited because a helicopter with the searching device can only fly to about 7,000 meters. most climbers who get lost are not below 7,000 meters. They're on the summit day, much higher than that. And then it's really impractical for any handheld type device to be in the right place at the right time to try to find someone above 7,000 meters. So not a bad rule, but not a rule that I actually think will effectively limit what happened last year, the deadliest year on the mountain when 18 climbers were killed. And when most of us agreed that a majority of those killed on the mountain were avoidable accidents, but they would have been avoided through experience of the climbers themselves or better decision-making of the guides and expedition leaders that led the teams that had those fatalities. And the new rules from the south side of Everest aren't addressing either of those two things. So I've talked a lot. Sam, regulations, you want to talk about any others or have any thoughts on those?
I mean, another one that I had heard about, and I don't know if this is stuck or if this was maybe a rumor, but that the Nepalese government will require that each team remove any bodies, any fatalities from the mountain. And, you know, as coming from it, from a human standpoint, that seems quite logical. Obviously, there's a lot of factors of, you know, the effort and safety required to remove a body from, you know, that 8,000 meter range is not quite as practical or logical as the rule itself. Is that rule still seeming to be stick? Is it going to stick? And how will they enforce that? Is that even feasible?
Yeah, it's all about enforcement. And it's certainly not a bad desire to bring bodies of lost climbers down. It should be a goal. As you said, it can be incredibly dangerous in the ice fall. I've attempted body recoveries for other teams in the ice fall and spent hours digging through the ice to try to recover bodies. And most of the time, I think what I was probably doing was unduly risking my life and the life of Sherpa teammates who agreed to go up and help. And we never should have been there. So I think there are places on the mountain where we should definitely not be recovering bodies. It's not a place that I think Nepal should be focusing energy. I do think they should be focusing on removing trash and human waste. They placed some new rules on the mountain, including everyone now has to poop in plastic bags called wag bags and bring those wag bags down. That's something Alpenglow's been doing for 15 years. It's just common sense. So really happy to see that expanded to all teams. Of course, the challenge is how to enforce it. Argentina and Aconcagua is a good example of this. They began regulating and requiring this a few years ago, just like Denali did here in the US. And in Argentina, you actually weigh your poop when you come down. And it's not an exact number, but we had this many climbers for this many days. There should be an estimated this amount. And if there isn't, there's really significant fines for the company that was running that trip and the risk of the company being removed from the mountain. And that's what's missing in Nepal is actual pain if you don't follow the thousands of regulations that have already been put in place. This one to remove poop, amazing, important regulation. Now we need to hear what are the penalties and how will they be doled out or enforced if teams don't, you know, follow the new regulation. So stay tuned.
A lot of interesting changes. I mean, I think there's the right sentiment, right? They're trying to address some of these issues that have been seen, particularly on the south side of the mountain. Most of the media that we see surrounding Mount Everest comes from these situations that occur on the south side, although the media doesn't always address that as such. So they're trying to do the right things, and with a little more effort, they can make some change.
100%. I just want to agree with that. Like, Nepal's heart is absolutely in the right place, and they have an incredibly difficult job, which is trying to manage one of the harshest environments on the entire planet, of which there is an insatiable desire to go to and incredibly high costs to do safely. It's such a difficult challenge. And Nepal is faced with so many other challenges politically, and the health of their population and how to grow. Like, wow. And so I do want to support Nepal in, you know, they want this mountain to be pristine. They want Mount Everest National Park to be a place that the world wants to visit for the incredible thing that it offers, you know, trekking in this remote environment where the tallest mountain on the planet exists. So you're so right, Sam, and it's easy for me to get on my soapbox and start talking about all the problems and maybe losing sight of the fact that Nepal is heading in the right direction. It's a hard road, and I and we in the guiding community should be supporting their efforts.
Well, a lot to be seen around the season. We'll be talking to you from base camp and maybe higher on the mountain, depending on our tech capabilities. So looking forward to following the Everest season with you there in the thick of it.
Absolutely. Me too. That's the news.
Coming up, we have our first episode interview with Emily Harrington.
Today's podcast is brought to you by Alpenglow Expeditions, a Tahoe-based guide company with an international reputation. In its 20th year of operations, Alpenglow leads the highest quality expeditions in some of the world's greatest mountain ranges, from California's High Sierra to the rugged Himalaya. Alpenglow runs more than 40 international expeditions per year, as well as offering a full menu of guided ski and climbing courses throughout California. Join us and experience the Alpenglow difference.
Today's guest is Emily Harrington. Emily is a mountain athlete. She's known mostly for her rock climbing, but I like to talk about her more as a mountain athlete because she's done so much more than just technical rock climbing. Emily started out as a sport climbing national champion. She won a handful of national championships here in the United States. She's won the Ouray Ice Festival. She's summited Mount Everest and Cho Yu. She's skied at 8,000 meters. She's attempted new routes on alpine peaks, and she's free climbed Big Walls in Yosemite. She's also a mom, which a lot of people like to talk about these days. Emily, welcome to the Duffel Shuffle.
Thanks for having me, you guys.
You!
This is here, so as fun. Always, with Adrian.
Yeah, I'm very excited for this guest. Really looking forward to learning more about you, Emily Harrington, and drinking wine across the room.
Emily's our first guest on the Duffel Shuffle, and it's a unique one in that Adrian is married to Emily. So we have a little inside scoop on a lot of what Emily Harrington is all about.
Which but Emily, makes it I fun think, and also you know, very intimidating. This might be my hardest interview of the season.
Well, we want to record the conversation after the podcast too. That'll be like the bonus episode.
Yeah, that's fine. You always get the best nuggets after the recording is over. So just don't stop the recording.
Perfect. Pro tip. Emily, tell us a little bit about where you are right now.
We are in Andermatt, Switzerland. It's in the Southern Alps. It is the ski area that we've come to 3 years in a row now. And we absolutely love it. It's kind of like a not crowded Chamonix. Don't tell anyone.
You just told everyone because everyone listens to the Duffel Shuffle.
It's pretty funny. We've actually had locals for the first time. This is our third year coming here. And for the first time, we've had locals here be like, maybe stop tagging Andermatt in your Instagram posts. And one of them was like, actually, can you just tag Engelberg on everything, even though we're in Andermatt? So we're now in Engelberg, Switzerland, and having a great season. Yeah.
Engelberg is way better anyway.
Yeah, they get a lot more snow there, I heard.
So
and the skiing's radder. Awesome. So you're on a ski trip.
Yeah.
Every year you do a big ski trip.
Yep.
And I think that kind of ties in to the Duffel Shuffle. Every time I've been to your house, there's a duffel bag in the entryway. It's either being packed or unpacked. You guys are constantly on the go now with a little one in tow. And a big child that comes with you as well to help out.
Yeah, that's true.
But the reality you guys are doing more than just rock climbing. You're skiing, you're climbing big peaks, you're going sport climbing, You're going to Yosemite to climb big walls. You really are known as a technical rock climber, but you embody so much more. What inspires you to just spend every day in the mountains?
I think I like the variety of what each discipline teaches me. And I don't get bored, but I get satisfied with one discipline after a short period of time, or a relatively short period of time, and then I want to shift and go to something else and be challenged by something else. So yeah, I guess just keeping it keeping variety is what has kept me motivated all these years for technical rock climbing, for skiing. I get excited to do different things. And I think I'm different than a lot of elite level athletes in that way. I don't think I could sport climb year round. I don't think I could ski year round. I really, really like mixing it up. I like kind of weaving in and out of different communities as well, and having friends who ski and having friends who climb. I really value those relationships and how different they are and those different communities.
Wait, so I have so many questions, but so yeah, how does skiers and climbers differ? You just said, you know, they're so different. How?
They are different. I think partially it has to do with my approach to skiing versus my approach to climbing. I'm far more serious about climbing. It's something that it's my career. It's kind of how I make my living. And I treat it much more serious. And I think I surround myself with people who take climbing very seriously. They have very specific goals. They train really hard for them. Whereas skiing is a little bit, yeah, you can have goals, but it's kind of more about enjoying the motion of sliding on snow. And I think there's a little more type one fun in skiing, even though there can be goals and you can train for them and all of these things. I think in a way, I think skiers have more fun than climbers. And I don't know, it's just like a little bit, but it's also my approach and my attitude. Like I have I'm much lighter when I am skiing. It's just my attitude is different. I don't put pressure on myself. I don't feel pressure. I just do it because I love it. And I love climbing as well, but it's different. So maybe it's my attitude towards the two.
That was nice. You didn't identify anything about the communities. You brought it in internal. That was well done.
I mean, it is internal, but like I've heard Michelle Parker say that she's kind of said before, like climbing's so goal oriented and I wish I had more goals in skiing. Like climbing is really good for me because it gives me this objective and this direction, and it's taught me how to set goals. And I thought that was really interesting coming from her, who's a pro skier. And she's like, doesn't seem to find that sort of direction in her skiing as much.
Mm-hmm. How do you think that has changed your climbing? You know, having that ability to just let go a little bit. Do you think that it's challenged your climbing? Because, you know, some sport climbers are just climbing constantly and that grade is constantly increasing. Or do you think it allows you to look at things from a fresh perspective and almost reset before each climbing block?
It's been a mix throughout my life. I think for a while it was like climbing and skiing kind of fought one another, and it was really hard for me to balance the two. And there was a lot of like guilt involved when I was skiing versus climbing. And when I go on ski trips, I'd feel really guilty for not training all the time. And I think I've gotten better at realizing that I need both, and that I like you're saying, that each one kind of provides a little bit of a reset and a fresh perspective on the other one. And recently in rock climbing, I've tried to be a little bit lighter about it. I think partially that's having a baby and everything changes. My relationship to climbing has changed. My relationship to skiing has changed. My relationship to the mountains has changed. And so I think recently I have a lot of gratitude towards both activities and what they've given me. And I've approached them both with a better attitude, more so climbing. I've really tried to approach my rock climbing this year with an attitude of, I want to enjoy it. I don't want to go into that dark place where I'm super negative and put a lot of pressure on myself and feel a lot of doubt and kind of spiral. So I think more than anything, being a mom has kind of helped me shift a lot of my attitude.
So we're definitely going to talk about being a mom on this podcast. How can we not?
Yeah, you can't not.
Em's been doing a whole lot of podcasts about being a mom these days.
Well, yeah. I think it's cool. It's being a mom has changed your perspective, but it hasn't defined who you are. And if there's anyone that shows that, that's you. You have, you know, accepted this new change of your life and really introduced your son Arrow to your life, not let him change your life. And I think that's the coolest part. And certainly your risk tolerance and things like that is, it's fun to talk about how that's changed. How has this impacted you? But I think how you're raising your child is more interesting than what your child is doing to you.
Yeah. I mean, we're doing our best. We don't really know what we're doing, but we're doing our best. And so far it's working. But yeah, we're trying to introduce him to climbing and skiing because we love it. And so he's around it all the time right now. And when he's old enough to make his choices, hopefully he gravitates towards the mountains. But you never know.
It is funny. He won't have a choice. Starting to make his choices. He's like, I only want to eat French fries, and I mostly want to just be inside throwing things. He loves balls so much, and neither me or Em play any ball sports whatsoever. So maybe this is the first time where he's like, I'll show you guys. We're going to play with balls.
The next time will be when he turns into a mountain biker.
Oh, he's definitely going to be a mountain biker. That's the one thing we don't do.
I know. Raising him in Tahoe, there is no way he
mountain bike, so.
They can take him out when we're not. And so, Em, I wanted to go back to you. I do think it's a really interesting thing, especially climbers, but all athletes at a high level, they really do, I think, feel some of that you mentioned, almost like guilt when they're doing another sport or activity or maybe taking a break from training and things like that. And you've certainly felt that at times and probably still do. But like, do you think having these other sports like skiing and even big mountain climbing, high altitude, like, have they made you a better rock climber in the long run? Or do you think you would have climbed harder, or how do you even define better? Like, how do you think it's either helped or hurt?
I don't know. I've asked myself that question a couple of times over the past few years. Like, if I didn't go to Everest, if I didn't continue to try to climb 8,000 meter peaks, if I hadn't taken that break, would I have climbed harder sport routes? Would I have? Yeah, I've sort of wondered that. But I don't think so. I think if anything, all of that has helped my motivation, and I've come back to sport climbing in with this passion that I kind of had lost when I was in my early 20s. And so I honestly think it's been really good for me. Yeah, maybe physically I could have performed better when I was younger, but that's only the physical side. And there's a mental side that's so massive that I think people don't account for. And I think I've matured so much in my climbing through all these other things that I've done and learn so much about myself that I think my successes in all the different elements have sort of built on each other. Or at least that's what I want to believe. So I'm going to say that it's true.
I think it's interesting. There's a lot of parallels to the sport of surfing as compared to like a waterman. You know, in the water culture, you have a waterman who is super diverse and super accomplished in many, many sports within the ocean. And then you have people that have pursued just one individual discipline, whether that be big wave surfing or, you know, technical competition surfing. And you talk to a lot of people that have done them all, and maybe they haven't performed at the highest level, but they're so accomplished at all of these sports that they come at each sport with a different perspective because they know the water, they know the ocean. And I would argue that, you know, you have such a diverse experience that you have much better mountain sense than a lot of people that may have focused on just one discipline within the world of climbing.
Yeah, I hope that's true. That's kind of been my goal, I guess, in my career, is to be able to practice all the different mediums. And some I obviously love more than others and am passionate about more than others. But it's kind of been a goal of mine to be competent in all the disciplines.
I think it's really kind of cool because I think it is how we, you know, Sam and you and me as mountain guides, like one of the cool things I love about the mountain guiding profession is kind of when it came out of the Alps, out of Europe, the idea was you weren't a mountain guide unless you guided rock, ski, and alpine, kind of the three classic disciplines. And so basically every mountain guide, according to the formal terminology from the Alps, is diverse and knows how to move through the mountains in many different ways. And it's something that's always really like sat right with me. I love that kind of way of looking at the mountains and moving through them. And so maybe that's how I ended up dating Emily. It was like, I saw some of that in her, like that same desire to move through the mountains in lots of different ways and to do them all at a really high level.
Yeah absolutely.
Well, I think that's kind of what I learned from my relationship with you, Adrian, is that sort of respect for all the disciplines and competency in all the arenas of, you know, mountains. And so, you know, in the, over the last 11 years, 12 years, however long we've been together, I've sort of like
so long
grown to really respect that and appreciate it. And so I think I do have this different perspective because I'm constantly surrounded by the guiding world and mountain guides, and I understand how it all works in Europe versus the US. And so I've always had this perspective, even though I'm not one myself, that is the, in my opinion, kind of the best approach to the mountains, is to be well versed in all the disciplines.
This is also why we're going on a bouldering trip this summer, because certainly it is not the discipline that I excel in within the disciplines of climbing. How about you, Emily? How's bouldering?
I am going to try to be a boulderer this summer. I know I really do love bouldering. I think it's one of the best ways to become better at rock climbing and to become stronger. And when I'm in the gym, that's all I do is boulder. It's what I prefer to do. I love going by myself and just bouldering. Outdoors, it's a little bit different. It's a little bit more logistically challenging, I think. And we just have to get into the mode. But I'm excited. I am excited because I'm one of those people that I want to be good at all the disciplines, and I want to do something that I'm proud of. And so I'm excited to go to Rocklands. We're going to South Africa in July, and it's going to be awesome. We're going to spend 3 weeks wrestling boulders.
And why South Africa?
It's just another part of your mountain sense.
Bouldering is another part of my mountain sense. Yes. I think, right? It is. I mean, bouldering originally originated in Europe as a way to train for mountains. So yeah, it all is a pyramid. Why South Africa? South Africa is a world-class bouldering destination, and I've never been. And basically, if you want to call yourself a boulderer, you have to go to Rocklands. And we have really good friends who are going to be there and who are from South Africa. So it's going to be awesome. And it's going to be a baby trip because they have a baby too.
So we're going to go switching gears a little bit from the smallest climbing to the tallest climbing. You and Adrian and Emily met on Mount Everest. You climbed and summited Mount Everest in 2012 with an expedition from the North Face. You've also climbed and I believe skied Cho Yu, which is another 8,000 meter peak in the Himalaya. You've attempted other 8,000 meter peaks. Talk a little bit about your experiences on the highest peaks of the world and kind of your relationship with that part of climbing.
Yeah. So I think in my early 20s, I was, like I mentioned before, I was burnt out from sport climbing and competitions and that high level performance side of climbing. And I was really looking for something else, something different. I was lucky enough to be on the North Face team at the time, and Conrad Anker invited me to go bolt some routes in the Khumbu for the Khumbu Climbing Center in Forte. So I went there in 2011 and was just sort of, my eyes were open to this world of high altitude climbing, and I was really drawn to it and fascinated by it. And I had also started ice climbing, and that's when I won the Uray Ice Festival. And so I was definitely expanding my mountain experiences. And kind of randomly, Conrad invited me to Everest the following year, 2012. And I really was super green. I didn't know anything about altitude. I'd never really been to high altitude. I got super sick. It was a pretty miserable experience for most of the time, but I did end up summiting, and that's where I met Adrian, and that's actually where I met Hillary Nelson, and we formed a really tight bond on that trip. And I think, you know, between the combination of Adrian and Hillary was why I continued to pursue mountain objectives. The following year I climbed Amma de Blam with Adrian. The year after that, I went to Myanmar, to Burma, to try to climb Hakaka Borazi with Hillary. We all went to Makalu the following year. And so I guess it was just a period of time where I was really inspired and motivated to go on big expeditions and kind of see how far I could push my body in that way. And it was a really great learning experience. And there's a part of me that wonders if I'll get back to that place. But soon, eventually, after a few years of doing that, I kind of realized that I couldn't perform in rock climbing and high altitude climb. And so I've definitely stepped away from it, I would say, in the last few years.
And how, I mean, I would assume that your experiences in those mountains on expeditions has impacted your time spent on Yosemite, on El Cap, just being out there remote, removed from society a little bit for an extended period of time in the elements and kind of pushing your body to the limit. How do you see those experiences? Do you think they've shaped your climbing? Have they changed you as a climber?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I think before I went into that world of high altitude climbing, I didn't really understand what suffering was or how to suffer, or the idea that you had to perform under unideal circumstances, which is basically all high altitude climbing is. And with big wall free climbing, like climbing on El Cap and trying to like free climb El Cap in a day, it's this perfect combination between this suffering and these unforeseen circumstances and kind of having to push through and hard technical rock climbing. So I think that base of being a sport climber and a competition climber and, you know, delving into this world of high altitude climbing kind of formed the base that later became big wall free climbing. And that's when I discovered that was one of my biggest passions.
Awesome. And so you say you don't know if 8,000 meter climbing or high altitude is in your future. How do you feel about its presence in your life in this day? You know, Adrian is still a mountain guide climbing at that level and guiding at that level. And how does that impact your life still?
Well, obviously it impacts our life in that he goes away for long periods of time. And I think that's the biggest thing that is hard. I'm not necessarily worried about him guiding Everest. I think I understand the risks pretty well. And I understand that that's a risk that we're both totally comfortable with. So there's not really any stress around him guiding per se, but there's stress around just the time away. And I think that is hard. And I think that's sort of why I stepped away from it, is logistically, it's just a lot. And it's a lot of buildup. And then it's the trip is a lot. And then there's a lot of recovery time that you kind of, I guess, don't really recognize until you're in it. And so it's several months out of the year of prep time and being on an expedition and then the aftermath of it. That's really hard on the person, but then also like the relationship.
Yeah. There was a number of years that we called Everest Steve, because Em was like, if I ever hear the name Everest again, I'm going to like break up with you and walk out of the house. And I can't even remember where the name Steve came from, but Everest was Steve for a long time. And where are you on the love-hate scale with Everest these days, Em? I think everyone affiliated with the mountain moves along the scale. Where do you sit these days?
Yeah, we called Everest Steve because it was just like this annoying, like the giant like presence that feels sort of unnecessary. And it annoyed me for several years because there was, you know, 6 months before you start planning the trip and the trip from the previous year was over like a month before that. So it's kind of just this all consuming thing. And I think I'm in a place where I'm less like that now because Everest is for Alpenglow has been canceled the last few years. So I haven't been surrounded by it for, since before COVID, which, you know, I'm sorry for that, but it was sort of a relief.
The most devastating thing that's happened in my like personal professional life. Em's like,
and I'm just like,
sweet. Yes.
No, I think I'm in an okay place. Like it's been long enough, and Adrian, you're obviously trying to be efficient and move quickly. And I know that it means a lot to you. And I know that, you know, it's an important part of the business and who you are and your career and everything. So I think this year I feel pretty good about it. And I think the important thing is I have a good plan. I have a good plan for childcare with Arrow and for my own personal goals and what I'm going to be doing. So I think it'll be hard, but I'm totally prepared for it.
You guys recently took Arrow to the Himalaya and did some trekking in Nepal. Did that inspire you, Emily, to potentially explore that part of the world with, you know, Adrian and Arrow again?
Yes, actually. I thought that trip was so magical. I sort of went into it with these expectations of this could be really hard. We could struggle. This is kind of a crazy thing to do with a one-year-old. And it turned out to be just one of the best trips that I will cherish forever. And I think I said it the other night, I was like, I think we should go back to Nepal every 2 years with him and do some sort of trek, something that neither of us, that we haven't done before. There's a lot of stuff I want to see in Nepal that doesn't involve high mountains, more like trekking and just random stuff that I think would be so fun to do with Arrow. And I do want to make it a goal to keep bringing him there. And I think it would mean a lot to the Sherpa that work for Alpenglow, Dorje and everyone who grew close to him on this trip. So it is something that I really want to continue to do, is keep going back to Nepal. But I don't know if I'll ever climb a big, big mountain again.
Well, that kind of leads me to my next question. In 5 years, if you had to describe kind of Emily Harrington's career in the next 5 years, obviously your current pursuit is bouldering at the highest, most extreme levels.
Let's not go that far.
What do you think the next 5 years will look like for Emily Harrington from a professional standpoint? And is there any part of climbing that you feel like you want to explore in the next 5 years?
Should we talk about like the three more kids? Four more kids, five
yeah,
more kids.
Yeah, we're going to do that.
Triplets.
No. Yeah, I do. I have like a good list that I would be ecstatic if I got any one of these things done on the list. I do have some goals that I've set for myself. I actually came back from pregnancy and postpartum stronger than I've been maybe ever, which is a weird feeling and a cool feeling and kind of like a stressful feeling, because I'm like, oh my God, I should use this strength for something. And now I'm on the ski trip. What am I doing? but I'm hoping to climb my hardest sport route, So that would be like 14C. And then I'm hoping to climb my hardest boulder problem, which really shouldn't be that hard because I've never really tried a hard boulder problem. So I think I'll achieve that one. And I'd love to continue to free climb on LCAP. And basically I'm trying to tailor my goals around what's logistically a little bit easier nowadays. And that does involve like less big, long expeditions and more sport climbing and climbing in Yosemite and bouldering and stuff like that. Cause I really haven't been ready to leave Arrow for long periods of time. And I'm not sure how it'll go in the next few years. I'm sure I'll be ready to go on some type of expedition. But I don't think it'll be like a big mountain expedition or anything like that. So yeah, those are kind of my rock climbing goals. I'd like to just continue to push myself for the next 5 years at least and perform better than I have.
Bringing it full circle and heading back to sport climbing at the highest level.
Yeah. Exactly.
Where it all began.
And it's kind of a cool story, right? I'm really motivated and I'm really enjoying rock climbing more than I have in a long time. I've taken a much more structured approach just because I have less time now. So I have a coach and I actually do both like physical training and mental training, which has been really cool. And it's kind of made me realize that I don't actually have to climb or train as much as I used to in order to perform better. It's more like quality over quantity. So that's been a really fun realization. And then I do want to continue to ski and be a good proficient skier and go on big ski trips and do things that I'm proud of.
Yes. And what did maybe tell us a little bit about who you're working with coaching wise? You know, you mentioned both mental and physical training. What does that look like and why now?
So I do lattice training, which is, I feel like they're kind of like the uphill athlete of rock climbing training. It's kind of like all the professional climbers now do it. And they're very well respected. Their kind of depth of knowledge is really good. They have a lot of really smart people who really dig into the science of training. And so I'm training with this girl named Madeline Cope. She's British and she's also a really accomplished rock climber. And she really helped me through the whole postpartum process and kind of building me a program to build back my strength. And it's been really effective. It's been awesome, honestly. I've always felt like I sort of knew how to train. But I think a lot of things that I was doing were inefficient and even maybe unhealthy in some ways. And I've never really been injured, which is pretty lucky for me. But I just feel like I train with much more purpose and I can do a lot more with a lot less time now. And then my friend Hazel Finley sent me her whole like catalog of mental training. She has a mental training platform called Strong Mind, and it's also really amazing, and she's super smart and kind of dives into the whole mental side of performance and athletics and the science behind it. And I really love it. And then I also work with a mental health coach. So there's a lot there.
Awesome.
Yeah, it's been really good.
And do you think, like, could you have benefited more from things like that or as well in your 20s? Or do you think, like, this was... I was on a very similar path. Like I didn't start working with coaches until my 30s, kind of mid 30s. And I think for me, at least, it was like this fear of potential decline that I was like, oh my God, I need help. And I got a nutritionist and I got a coach and started working in the gym and doing all these things that I just totally made fun of in my 20s. Obviously I wasn't in the same structured pro like comp climbing world you were, but do you think like, it would benefit younger athletes to start trying to integrate these things into their programs earlier? Or was your path kind of like the way?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think it depends on the person. I think I certainly would have benefited from more structured training in my 20s, but you know, it's hindsight. I don't know that I might not have gone to Everest and decided to climb 8,000 meter peaks and done what I did in the mountains.
And we would never have met, and Ara would never have been born.
Yeah. Yeah.
And those little buck teeth wouldn't be here in the world.
So, and I think now climbing is so much, it's so different. The depth of like the training and everything, yes. And it's Olympic sport now, and it's changed so much. And the level is so high that, yeah, of course, I think the younger you are starting with that type of training, I think the better off you're going to be, as long as you can avoid the burnout and injury. But yeah.
But I also think through experience, through body awareness, development and such, and mental challenges, ups and downs, you are able to appreciate more from training and maximize the opportunities. Whereas if you don't have that experience, maybe that training is less focused and less valuable.
Yeah, I think so. And I think, I don't know, in my 20s, I kind of didn't really know what I wanted. I think there was a part of me that like didn't really care about rock climbing hard after a certain point. And so I just didn't have that many structured goals. And now I have some very deliberate goals. And it took me a while to come around to that and to realize what I wanted to do with climbing. So I think there's a maturity aspect as well.
I do think it's a really exciting time for our kind of like industry or the sports we play in that, you know, you mentioned like uphill athlete and now there's Evoke Endurance as well. Scott Johnston's training company, both Uphill and Evoke really work with a lot of high altitude athletes, both pro athletes and, you know, recreational climbers going to mountains like Everest and Denali and things like that. And I just see, I think there's so much potential for amazing things to be done in the big mountains and in climbing in your world as more like sort of structured Olympic style coaching join with mountain sports or action sports, air sports that have traditionally not had the same level of coaching, training, nutrition, focus. I think it's a really exciting time in the sport where we're going to see just wild things being done.
Yeah, because it doesn't seem like in high altitude climbing, I guess maybe the youngest people now have kind of come up with this type of structured training, but it's still kind of the old guard doing a lot of the really, really out there stuff. And so I think in the next decade or so, you're going to see it elevated because there's so much more knowledge.
Just to be clear, did you just categorize Adrian as the old guard?
Well, maybe, but he's also, I mean, he's done quite a bit of stuff, but it's kind of a while ago, even.
I went so quickly. I went so quickly from being a wannabe to a has-been. I never even, I'm not sure I ever stopped in the actual middle between the two. But I do find myself getting older and grumpier in my opinions of mountain things. I think it was actually Honnold a few days ago that reminded me that I need to be careful I don't become a curmudgeon. No, he actually told me to be careful I didn't become a curmudgeon. And I was like, ooh. And it's kind of like, that's what I've been thinking about when I've been going on training runs these days. So thanks, Alex.
Yeah.
Wait, am I a curmudgeon? Emily Harrington?
No, but maybe I am too. So I just can't see it.
Oh, wow. Real talk.
Well, a true curmudgeon knows that a terrible duffel shuffle story is really what makes an epic expedition. So Emily, we'll wrap this episode up with what your best duffel shuffle story.
I think I would have to say it is 2014, this sort of doomed expedition to Myanmar for National Geographic and the North Face. We treated it like it was going to be an expedition to any other mountain, like in Nepal, where you can bring all your stuff to base camp. And we had like 40 duffel bags, all this camera stuff, all this food. And we got to the trailhead essentially. And there was like 7 porters. And they were just like, what are you doing? Like we can each take 2 duffel bags. And so like throughout this trip started in like the capital city. And then we took this like train and we took a boat and we like took these motorcycles. So we were 3 weeks in to the trip before we got to the trailhead, which is when we were going to walk 125 miles into the jungle. And we'd gotten all our stuff to that point. And then we just started having to like shed duffels along the trail as we got closer and closer to the mountains. Because at first we had, you know, a certain number of porters, and then we'd wake up the next day and like two of them would leave and they'd be gone and we'd never see them again. And so then we'd be left with only like five porters. And so we just kept having to leave stuff. And we finally got to the mountain and we basically had no food left or anything. And we tried to climb the mountain, failed miserably, ran out of food, walked back out, got back on the motorcycles, and the trip was over. But it was really awesome. It was this like really cool.
Wait, I'm going to add in here. In retrospect, it's really awesome. So this trip, Emily and I had just really started dating, yeah. And I think I had a canceled expedition or something. So I was on a beach in Thailand for like the entirety of this, I don't know, 7 week long expedition. And Em would call from a satellite phone just like, this is the worst thing ever. And I'd be like, well, I'm eating curry and drinking.
I mean, yeah, it was pretty terrible at the time. But like looking back, we survived.
But that's true adventure.
Awesome. Yeah. And yeah, we basically tried to climb a mountain with no food and no gear.
And didn't end up climbing.
No, but we made it, you know, decently far.
Pretty much left as friends. Like,
yeah, I left as friends with everyone, mostly.
It is true, Sam. It is the, I've heard this story so many times now, and it just seems like the ultimate distillation of everything that the mountains can be in terms of adventure, regardless of the outcome. Pretty solid duffel shuffle.
I mean, yeah. Story. And Renan made a film and he called it Down to Nothing. And it's true. It's a great film, too.
I'm going to add it to the list. All right, Emily, for your next adventure, what is the one piece of gear that you're excited about putting in your duffel? Could be a new thing or something you always bring.
Oh my gosh. Wow. I didn't know this question was coming.
I think we're going to send our guests these questions in advance, you know, but you're just getting thrown in the fire. Let's go. What do you got?
My next piece of equipment that I'm most excited to bring on a trip.
Like the first thing you're going to put in the duffel bag. Like it's got to be there.
Well, we need to bring crash pads to South Africa. And we still haven't. All right. That. They don't even go in a duffel.
This is going to make for a very good story.
Like,
how do you pack crash pads? To South Africa.
No. I think you just shove stuff inside of them and then somehow tie it all up and then you check that bag.
Emily is excited about her crash pad.
Terrible idea.
I don't even have any crash pads.
I'll
we really have
some.
To get started on this.
That's what I should have bought you for Valentine's Day.
Well, that's not true. I have a few, but we have a lot of figuring out to do. The logistics of bouldering are way different than anything I've ever done. So
you need shoes, chalk bag, and many, many crash pads.
And a fan. You need a fan. Many fans.
Some brushes, like different bristles.
You need different size brushes.
Maybe like a step ladder.
You need a ladder.
Ladder to get to the top.
You need a step ladder. You need a ladder.
You definitely need lights because everyone climbs at night, not day.
Yep.
I thought bouldering was supposed to be the purest style of climbing.
You guys can discuss this, but it's a lot.
That might be our next podcast.
it's an endeavor. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, Emily, thank you for taking the time to be with us on our first episode of the Duffel Shuffle. We hope you have fun skiing in Andermatt. Engelberg.
Engelberg. And Emily, tell us all, you know, if we want to follow along on your adventures, family or otherwise, where should we find you?
I'm on Instagram, Emily A. Harrington, and then Adrian and I have our YouTube channel about our family adventures, and it's called Danger Stick TV on YouTube. And season 6 is coming out in the next few weeks.
Thanks for listening to episode 1 of The Duffel Shuffle with Emily Harrington. If you enjoyed the episode, please subscribe on your favorite podcast platform and leave us a review. Our next episode will drop April 16th. We'll hear from Ecuadorian mountain guide and Black Diamond athlete Topo Mena. Topo talks about his life in the mountains, a recent accident paragliding, and his ongoing recovery. And until then, we hope you enjoy some time outdoors.